Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It is the 6th of April, and it's very nice to have you with us. Let me introduce our panel, and we'll get started. Obviously, a lot of news, and we'll talk about all of this stuff in just a moment. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe. I'd call you Uncle Joe, but that's what they used to call Stalin.
Is that what they used to call Stalin? Oh, yeah, Uncle
Joe. They did, and they also used to call the guy on Petticoat Junction Uncle Joe.
I didn't watch that.
Pop reference right program. Away.
What, you're on your mic there. There you go.
It's a lousy program.
What, Petticoat Junction?
Yeah.
Did you like the Beverly Hillbillies better?
No, except that Scruggs and Flat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Beverly
Hillbillies.
Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, they were regulars on that
show. Pearl, don't give your love to Earl.
You're a good man. You are really good. I don't praise you much, Shira, but I'll tell you on that one, you
not nearly
get
enough.
And this is the first time I've met Teresa, and she's looking at me like, "What did I get into?"
What happened? You know, when I was in high school, this was in the mid '80s. We had so cable was just starting, and we had a cable access station within the high school cable access TV station, and it was one of the classes that I took both in my sophomore, junior, and my senior year, and I had a show daily that I would go in and do at 8 o'clock in the morning called the Uncle Joe Show.
Wow.
Those
That's
tapes
impressive.
Have all been burned.
So you and Ira sort of have a thing going. I just called out Ira, and you said, I don't praise you enough, and you said, and I heard you say it, not nearly enough. I heard you say that, and I took some exception.
I would probably say that to anybody.
But you said it about me, don't you see?
No, but I mean, I don't know that any of us are praised enough.
No.
That's what I meant.
I'll withdraw.
Okay, that's fine. I apologize.
For what?
Ira, you're a son of a bitch.
Oh, my goodness.
You can't do that.
Bite me.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable.
just a general blanket apology for the whole thing.
Teresa Bourgeois, I have nothing to say but love for you. So thank you very much.
Me too. I'm with you.
Well, thank you. Feeling the love. Thank
Teresa,
you.
Teresa was a late addition last night, so I thank her very much for filling in. That was very sweet. And Ira Fussvold, again, thank you very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Daily Freeman, publisher emeritus. Okay, well, we will get to what is happening in the world at large, and we begin with President. Let's begin with Steve Bannon, actually, because we'll talk about Syria in a moment, but we'll get to the news that broke shortly after this program finished yesterday. And that was that Steve Bannon, who was named to the National Security Council, has been removed from that point. White House officials say the ideologist who enjoyed the president's confidence became increasingly embattled as other advisors, including Mr. Trump's daughter and son-in-law, complained about setbacks in health care legislation. Lately, Mr. Bannon has been conspicuously absent from some meetings, and now he has lost his seat at the national security table. In a move that was widely seen as a sign of changing fortunes, Mr. Trump removed Mr. Bannon, his chief strategist, from the National Security Council's cabinet-level principals committee on Wednesday. The shift was orchestrated by Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, Mr. Trump's national security advisor, who you will remember replaced Michael Flynn, who insisted on purging a political advisor from the Situation Room where decisions about war and peace are made. That from the New York Times. Alan, what do you make of it?
Well, Joe, first of all, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. And I think almost everybody with my political perspective thinks that. I wanted to ask you guys a question because you're a vast repository of information. It was Bannon who ran the election, basically, right? Who set the philosophy for the election?
He came in after Manafort, yeah.
Yeah. So he was owed sort of big time.
Well, he was Mercer's guy, you know, Mercer's
black
money.
Black money Mercer.
With Mercer, yeah, with black money Mercer's money came Bannon and Kellyanne Conway. And
right.
Voices, three people.
Who both seem to be...
on the wane.
Quieter
Well, they've certainly kept her in the background much more. She got so much bad publicity, and then she was on the cover of New York Magazine, described as the, in effect, the First Lady, and that did not sit well in the White House, apparently. But there's so many stories out there, and you have to hope that the sources who are reporting them are accurate.
Yeah.
But it seems if there is a consensus that there is and has been two or three or more factions in the White House, and you have the Bannon group, and you have the Rance Priebus group, and then you have, and apparently the most important group at all, the Jared Kushner group. And the most recent reporting that I read is that Kushner is holding sway here. And, of course, Trump listens to him very significantly. In fact, he's now being jokingly referred to as Secretary of State Kushner because he's going to Iraq and places that you'd think Tillerson would go to. So at any rate, it appears as if Bannon has not fared well within the other factions in the White House.
That's a very good point you're making, Ira, about people who were leaking the reasons that he's got that he's gotten sort of downgraded, and one of which is that Trump doesn't like being called assistant to Bannon, mm-hmm. assistant president, and all the rest of it. But your point is very well taken. How do we know that stuff really is true?
Well, we don't. Bannon is already denying a report that was in the New York Times this morning about all of this. But it just seems to all add up that this is correct. And it also, what perhaps more importantly than other things, is that the two or three issues like health care that Bannon has supposed to be piloting to victory for Trump, he's winding up losing. And Trump,
well,
we know, doesn't want to win, doesn't want to lose.
There's an alternative to that theory, which is they gave him health care knowing that it was gonna put him up against the wall, that he could succeed.
Yeah, and health care, I think, is as much the Priebus faction, because it's really Priebus and working with Ryan. But, a couple of things. This could be because of the Jared Kushner, issues that have been reported, or it really could be because the price of getting General McMaster's was that he wanted control of the National Security Council, and so that it could be something that simple. Or I think the timing is what I was most fascinated by. So I wonder if it's possible there's any of the Russian connection issues involved
here. Or even
the
Chinese connection.
Or the Chinese connection.
Xi showing up today.
Because it really, the timing, there's so much that happened yesterday that in a way didn't make a lot of sense. Because you had the Crown Prince Abdullah of Jordan there. You had the Chinese visit coming up. And you had the Syrian question. And so in the midst of all of that, they announced this change, this staff change, plus Trump called had the New York Times come in to have a trial balloon on infrastructure, and in the midst of that went after Rice, Obama's team there. After the Times itself. So there seemed to be a lot of deflection going on, and so when there's deflection, usually two or three days later you figure out what that's about. And in the midst of all of that, you have the Supreme Court justice issue up on Capitol Hill. So the timing was rather odd, and I don't think we know the full story yet, but it may be something as simple as it's the price of getting General McMaster's.
Is it... There was so much concern as to what was happening in the National Security Council when Steve Bannon was named, and that position was defined as much as it was. And what I'm interested in now is because the position has still been redefined, there are other people who are now part of it, right, that have been still added to the equation, the energy, right? Energy Department?
Well, yes. They have added people who probably should have been in on the know from the very beginning to the group. McMaster, by the way, hasn't gotten everything he wanted.
No.
He wanted an assistant who the president said no to because apparently had said some things that he didn't like during that time. Look, this is a mercurial guy, Trump. And he goes up in the air, and it is possible that the rumors that he just didn't want to compete for publicity with Bannon. It's also possible, and I'm working on this one, this theory, that Ivanka Trump really has become such an important player that she does an interview 2 days ago in which she says, you know, I tell my father things that he might not agree with, but he always listens. Boom. Bannon gets fired.
But he's just the that is possible, too. But yeah. I think we have to step back and realize that the only change that's happened here is he's now not on the National Security Council. And I think that he has been the quiet and, you know, unfortunately, from my point of view, effective lead on these executive orders that are creating dramatic changes within the government.
Yeah.
And so while he may not be on the National Security Council, he still can be chipping away at some core foundations of our government on the domestic side with this focus on these executive orders that have been used in unprecedented ways to
I don't know, because I was watching Morning Joe, a man who I don't like either.
You've got to stop watching that
this
show.
Morning. Well, he gets your blood pressure going in the morning. And I was watching him, and I think I heard them saying, he and his compatriot, that this was the first step in the de-Bannonization of the White House, the first step. You know, once they take something away from you and you're on the wane, it doesn't take long before some of the other things follow. Some of the other job descriptions follow. And there were wide reports that he told all kinds of people, I'm going to quit. I'm not going to take this.
And the Mercers intervened and convinced him to stay.
Yeah, right.
Because they have an agenda.
Right, there are too many people on either side of the aisle who are concerned about Bannon leaving. They're pleased to see Bannon get diminished. And if he was to say, I don't want to hang on anymore, we would say, you know, here's your hat, there's the door.
Right.
You would say that.
Yes, I would say that.
But there are a group of people who got him, who helped get Donald Trump elected, who would not be happy.
Exactly.
I mean, I think for the better of the policy in the country and for the Democrats and the Republicans to come together and such, but there is that faction led by the Mercers, again, these money folks, and others, these ultra-conservatives, who he's their guy in the White House. And that is what reportedly Jared Kushner and others are pushing back against. But we shall see.
If it was almost anybody else except Donald Trump who is unqualified, incompetent, untrustworthy, and does not belong in that office.
Tell us what you really think.
Yes, if it was anybody else but him, I would say that he has now looked back on his nearly 3 months of being president and has seen that his poll numbers are at 34%, and that some of his initiatives are already failing, and that his White House is in disarray and they're in factions, and that he is finally saying to himself, "We better try to straighten some things out here, and let's move forward."
Don't now, you think that's a possibility?
I think it is a slim possibility, but I think it's a possibility.
No, I think it's a real possibility. Yeah. I think that Kushner and Ivanka have his back on this stuff and are recommending that he do that. And I'll bet you anything, he gets rid of this guy, you're going to see his poll numbers start to go up a
little
bit.
And don't forget, we all agree, I think, that the man is a narcissist and he wants to succeed and he does not have an ideology. And if he has to pivot, and I hate to use that word, and all of a sudden do things differently that will make people like him, he will do it.
I think he does have an ideology, Ira. It's an operational ideology, but you can winning, as Teresa just said, is one way to look at it. But also, you can take all of these decisions, all these executive orders, put them next to each other, and you could come up with an ideological way of looking at government, a way of looking at the rest of, you know, his world, which is quite clear to me anyway. I think he has an ideology.
I think he wants to get rid of all of the regulations that bothered him when he was trying to build his buildings, and he think he likes tax breaks. But again, this could be something as simple as McMaster, you know, General McMaster, the National Security Advisor. This is, you know, one of the things that he was promised when he came in, and he wants to run a more traditional operation, and this is a more traditional operation. I never understood, frankly, how did Stephen Bannon get security clearance, given his background. But, and then the other question is, was he involved at all with this the leaking? Because he's the one who McMaster wanted to fire this Urza Cohen-Wortnick, who was in the security staff, and Bannon intervened and said no, and that is the person who was involved in getting Nunes the documents, too. So I think there's more to be... The timing of this is
good
very
point.
Unusual. The timing of this, why it was done in the midst of so many other things going on, there's a reason that they needed to do this quickly, and I think we'll know in a few days more about that.
Obviously, we're going to talk much more about Syria and about what is going on there. But when we're talking about ideology, as Alan mentioned, that he has an ideology, does ideology necessarily mean policy? Because when you look at this, he seems just completely bereft of any idea of what he wants to do. We're going to do something. We're going to take care of it. We're going to make it better than it was before. But what is that policy?
Yeah, we have seen very little delivery. You're exactly right, Joe.
Right. And even yesterday, I listened to the New York Times two reporters, Glenn Thrush and Maggie Haberman,
mm-hmm. right? That's right?
Were called in quickly to float this trial balloon, apparently, to float this trial balloon on an infrastructure bill. And if you read about that, and I listened to Thrush being interviewed last night, it was clear that the... President Trump seemed to have little grasp of the substance of even an infrastructure bill, which you would think on that, given his background, he would have a grasp of. And it's the people around him who kept intervening and providing detail. So even on something where, you know, he spent his career in real estate and you would think that he'd at least be interested in the policy aspects of an infrastructure bill, they said it was clear he didn't have a grasp of that. And again, why, in the midst of everything yesterday, why float try a balloon on an infrastructure bill?
Well, that didn't even prove to be the lead story out of that. You know, Susan Rice.
He stepped on his message.
Yeah, Susan Rice and Bill O'Reilly were the stories that came out of that interview.
And I think the issue is they're trying to put together a tax bill. They didn't get the health bill. They need the money from the health bill. And so they just want an infrastructure bill to attach to a health bill to pull it through so that they can get the tax breaks they need.
The man is incompetent. I don't know how we can avoid saying that. The man, you know, you watched that press conference with the king yesterday, he's full of the same kinds of lines. I promise you that, or I really want to tell you that, or his ad-libs were just nonsensical. And I was trying to read the face of King Abdullah, and every once in a while he'd sort of look up with a look that to me said, who the hell is this guy?
And could I disagree with you mildly there?
Just and about 30 seconds.
A religious comment. Thank God he's incompetent.
Because?
Well, because he's not getting done things like health care.
Well, but he's dangerous.
Else. Well, he's dangerous, all right, but it's not as if he's getting the stuff done which we thought he was going to get done, or he thought he was going to get done.
Well, a day like today with the Syria question, the North Korea question, the Chinese leader here, it's a very tricky time to have a president who doesn't know the substance.
We'll pause there and we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and our panel discussion. Alan Chartok is here, Teresa Bourgeois, and Ira Fussfeld. There he is. We welcome you all, and we have letters that we're going to read, and people get their letters to us by writing to panel, P-A-N-E-L, panel, at wamc.org.
So, Tammy says, I'd like to hear the panel's thoughts on Nikki Haley's speech at the UN regarding the Syrian chemical attack. She's been under attack for using the photos as props and alluding to U.S. intervention. Teresa, what do you think?
If you haven't listened to it, I recommend go to C-SPAN somewhere and listen to it. What was fascinating to me is that it was a very forceful commentary, and it seemed disconnected to what's going on with the president.
Exactly.
And
what do you mean disconnected? Sorry.
It was so forceful against the Russians. She really called the Russians to task.
It is the Russians.
Is the Russians.
Right, but that's not what Trump is saying.
The thing is, it was a very hard line. It was very fascinating. I think there's nothing wrong with using the pictures because that is part of what's driving the focus now. And but I think that her comments, clearly calling out the Russians, were not consistent with what President Trump has been saying. And so you see this morning the Russians saying, well, what is your policy in Syria? The Russians this morning, their question to the U.S. is, and I think it's a valid one, U.S., what is your mm-hmm. policy in Syria?
Knowing full well that he doesn't have one.
And so, you know, you wonder if she got a phone call or if they're fine with that or what. But there was she took a much harder line than the president whom she represents mm-hmm. at the UN. It was a fascinating talk.
Corey says, putting aside Bannon's apparent moral failings, he appeared to be the only non-war hawk in that administration. We know that Goldman Sachs guys have staffed the financial seats of this administration, and now it appears that the neoconservatives are back in charge of foreign policy. So what has really changed from one administration to the other going back some 60 years now? It's a sad day when voices who advocate for less violence on the world stage are distanced from the president. And that's from Corey. And I think what Corey is saying to us is that Bannon was a peacemaker as opposed to the military establishment, which is now taking over. I certainly don't see Bannon in that sense. And I don't see him as a responsible human being, to tell you the truth. Anyway, whatever that's worth.
I think Bannon is fundamentally a disruptor. I mean, he was that at Breitbart. And I think he's looking to disrupt the order in the U.S., and Breitbart's looking to disrupt the order in Europe. And I think he's fundamentally thinks that, and he's talked about how you need to, quote-unquote, blow these systems up.
Buongiorno panel, says Bob. Buongiorno, Bob. On the heels of what Ira said, Reid Kushner, Secretary of State, don't forget Secretary of Defense, Treasury, National Security Advisor, right. And just about every other.
Yeah, Frank Bruni in his column in the Times yesterday said, when you send in your income taxes, do you send them to the Internal Revenue or do you send them to Kushner?
Oswald said.
And what qualifications does he bring to the table? And what
he's rich.
And what
conflict? In America, that's what you need to do.
He's
and
married
what
to Trump's daughter. Yeah.
What conflicts of interest does he bring to the table, too?
Does anybody care about that?
Well, I think we all should care about that.
Well, we should. There's no question you're right. We should. But does anybody really care? Because if they really cared, there'd be marches. There'd be people with pots and pans. There'd be people around the White House. It ain't happening.
I mean,
well,
I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say I was among those who was stupid enough to say that Trump could not win this election. And so now here we are, and I'm saying the man's numbers are 34%. If he does not get impeached or resign before the next election and he runs for reelection, and if the Democrats put anybody who can get up there and speak well and have a good be the right candidate, there's no way that this guy has enough support to win another
election.
Don't
forget the Electoral College. Don't forget the Electoral College. Don't forget those four key states, mm-hmm. which are so important. And I want to see what the polling is saying there. We do know one thing. It is true his numbers are going down, Ira. But they're not going down in terms of the faithful, the people who elected him.
Right. He has his base. And by the way, do you know who is at 14%?
Who?
Mitch McConnell.
Yes.
Right. Mitch McConnell has the lowest rating between Trump, Schumer, McConnell, and Paul Ryan.
I think Ryan's at 16.
I thought Ryan was higher than Schumer's and a little bit higher than Trump's, but that we're all more or less in the same ballpark.
And the turtle goes on. Panel, can Article 4 of the Constitution be used to declare a president of the United States incapacitated as claimed by H. Brandt Ayers, the former publisher of the Anniston Star in Alabama, in the Times Union, April 4th, 2017? I have read the article, and I'm having trouble seeing how that applies. He claims that a majority of the cabinet could invoke this article. Well, there's an amendment to the Constitution which lays it all out, but you'd have to get a will on the part of the people that Trump nominated in order to get rid of him. Sure, they could do that. They could say, "Well, we think he's out of his mind, and therefore we have to remove him and put the vice president in." And there's all kinds of things. If they do this, then they have to do that. Yeah, they could do it, but they're not gonna.
Right, I could take a trip to the International Space Station, but it's not going to happen.
CNN is reporting a source who speaks with Trump privately says he has begun asking friends, what do you think of my team?
Well, that's a fair question. don't you think?
It's doing focus groups now.
Okay, Michael says, hello, panel. With tax day quickly approaching, I was thinking about how to show Trump that normal everyday people, not just the media, want to see his taxes. To do so, I propose that everyone uses his favorite means of communication, Twitter. This can be done by everyone nationwide sending Trump a tweet at the same time. In other words, 4:15 2017 at 3 p.m., et cetera. All the tweets asking him how to asking him to show his taxes. Regards. Mike.
I do believe on April 15th there are a number of people who are doing marches and other actions to call for him to disclose his tax returns.
Christopher says, I think the ultimate winners will be the Kushner faction. Ivanka and Jared have the most experience in handling Trump and can't be sidelined nearly as easily as anyone else. That's a very good point. I mean, you don't tell your daughter and your son-in-law to disappear.
Unless you're Kim Jong-un. It gets rid of his cousins.
Well,
half-brother.
He does it a different way. He murders them.
And certainly you can imagine that the Pence and Priebus faction will go toward the Kushner and
Christopher says, again, the next paragraph, apart from that, the Mercer's policy preferences, radical as they are, require focus, work, and sacrifice. Trump can avoid all three of these things by letting a standard Republican agenda happen. Thanks always, Christopher Malmody.
Wasn't it a Darth Kearns Goodwin book about Lincoln, the team of rivals?
Yes.
I mean, there is nothing that says that there can't be factions of varying points of view. In fact, many would say it's healthy. You know, but the determinant factor is the man at the top. And as I may have said earlier in the show, this man is incompetent. I don't feel comfortable trusting any decision that he talks about.
But also to Teresa's earlier point of what are the qualifications of those people, even the team of rivals, mm-hmm. what's the qualifications of those individuals?
Right. And he actually has a cabinet. And so this is going to get more and more confusing as Jared Kushner steps in where the Secretary of State should be, or the Secretary of Commerce should be, or on and on. And there's going to be an information flow and a decision flow that just is not going to work over time. And then, but in the end, what effect does this have on the American people? Why, you know, besides the intrigue of the infighting, what difference does this make in people's lives?
Well, let me just
and that's really the core here that matters. What difference will this make in people's lives?
Well, let me just say, to be fair, FDR had a habit of circumventing the Foggy Bottom Boys too, and sending each of his Harry Hopkins, Louis Howe, all of these people to do the State Department work. So it is not unknown to use other people other than the people at the FDR apparently thought that the State Department people would do anything to screw it all up for him.
Well, President Obama, some complained that he went around, not after Secretary Clinton left, that he went around his State Department as well, not as much, but it's not unheard of. But the question is, do you have a diplomatic staff in place so that while all of these various decisions are being made, that the president is hearing from these different factions? And that's having the right chief of staff who's a broker of these various ideas, not part of one of the factions. And that's not happening.
We have heard from HVPP. Eric says, Bannon and Kellyanne got Trump elected. Bannon and Heritage Foundation are architects of executive orders. I am praying Bannon will be going. He is the man behind the curtain. And that's from Eric. Okay. Thanks for the thoughtful discussion, says Peter. I agree with Ira's perspective that Trump will twist and turn to become more popular. He's only in it for himself and his popularity. Moderation can make a difference, or are we headed towards a Pence-driven government? Peter in Hillsdale.
Very wise point.
Well, it is. It's an interesting idea.
It's a very wise point that it's Pence behind. I think Pence is behind a lot of these executive orders, along with Bannon.
Well, good morning, panel, says Nicholas. Could Bannon's removal be Trump's response to his negative poll numbers? I think so, by the way. I think all these conservative voters are going to see they elected. I think all those conservative voters are going to see they elected. I think there was a word left out.
Yes.
Who they elected. Okay. Trump has no ideology. He will do and say whatever is popular at the moment. I don't know about that. See, I think he'd be saying some much more popular things if he was smart. I don't see that as, you know, because if he did want to do things, I was just thinking, wouldn't it be interesting if his next Supreme Court appointment was Merrick Garland? Then he was looking for rapprochement.
Well, he is, you know, for all of his untrustworthiness, he has done a lot which remarkably speaks to what he talked about during the campaign, and in particular, draining the swamp. And, you know, they have succeeded in attempting to tear down a lot of regulations. And to your point, Alan, his supporters wanted this. So those are the people who wanted it, and that's what he's doing. But what troubles me is when he does it and he says the American people have spoken. Well, yeah, the American people, don't use that argument, because most of the American people didn't vote for you.
We're going to take a break. We will note that there is CNN is reporting that the House Intel Chair, Devin Nunes, is stepping aside from the Russia probe.
Big deal.
This after days, I guess weeks, really, of concern and calls for him to remove himself from that probe. And just as it was about to restart, he is stepping away. We'll find out more information about that as soon as it becomes available. In the meantime, we'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Pastor Luis Perez, Pastor Rhinebeck Reformed Church, and author Catharsis, Maldonado's Journey Through Grief. Available at Oblong Books Rhinebeck on Facebook. UHY Advisors, accountants and tax advisors to business, government, and not-for-profits, serving the Capital Region for over 50 years. UHY-US.com. Primrose Hill School, hosting an open house on their farm campus in Rhinebeck Saturday, April 8th, enrolling nursery through 5th grade and summer camp. PrimroseHillSchool.com. And the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang.
As we mentioned right before the break, that the breaking news is that Representative Devin Nunes is stepping down from the Russia probe. I'm going to read a statement that he just released. The House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence Chairman Devin Nunes today issued the following statement. Several left-wing activist groups have filed accusations against me with the Office of Congressional Ethics. The charges are entirely false and politically motivated, and are being leveled just as the American people are beginning to learn the truth about the improper unmasking of the identities of U.S. citizens and other abuses of power. Despite the baselessness of the charges, I believe it is in the best interest of the House Intelligence Committee and the Congress for me to have Representative Mike Conaway, with assistance from Representatives Trey Gowdy and Tom Rooney, temporarily take charge of the committee's Russia investigation while the House Ethics Committee looks into this matter. I will continue to fulfill all my other responsibilities as committee chairman, and I'm requesting to speak to the Ethics Committee at the earliest possible opportunity to order and expedite, excuse me, in order to expedite the dismissal of these false claims.
Well, by the time that he's done this, basically the Republicans in the House have given up. They're not doing an investigation because he's so damaged the reputation of his committee. So I don't see that this is any big deal, except that there may be something going on here that we don't know about what somebody has delivered to the Ethics Committee, because he does seem to be reacting to the Ethics Committee as the progenitor of this move. And that could be interesting once we find out.
Teresa.
Right. Clearly, I think we'll know more in a few days. There's more to this story. There's much more to this story. But that he continues to push this notion about that Trump laid out there about Susan Rice, Obama's person, is just astounding to me. People on both sides of the aisle who are experts in this issue say that it's just another false claim layered on top of President Trump's false claim that President Obama wiretapped him. And this is just not responsible governing. These are serious questions. I mean, it's a serious question. It's a bipartisan serious question about what the Russians did or didn't do in intervening with the U.S. elections in 2016. And to try to deflect efforts to get to the bottom of that by layering in false charges about a president wiretapping and then his staff, false claims about actions by his staff, is really unbecoming of a member of Congress or a person in government. So I think for whatever reason he stepped aside, I think that's healthy for our democracy.
Well, you mentioned it. What I was going to say is let's go back to where this all begins, which is the Trump tweet accusing Obama of wiretapping. Before that, there was the primary mission of this committee and the House and the Senate committee was to investigate how and who was involved with Russia attempting to hack our election. And as a result of the Trump tweet and all that has followed and the Nunes issues and the Susan Rice allegation, the Congress has been, and most of official Washington, has been distracted from the business of running this government at a time when there are crises all over the world, where there are serious issues to deal with within our country, and it is just a crime, and I don't mean it in the literal sense, that this all begins, in my opinion, with the Trump tweet. And in case you didn't know it, I think the man is incompetent. But
we had a letter to you, Ira, saying.
So far, we've had two that have been favorable. How's this one?
No, not so good.
Not so good. Okay.
Ira's statement. Ira is making the same mistake he made before.
Yes, could
he
be.
He just said he didn't believe Trump can be reelected after stating he didn't believe he could be elected in the first place. He can, capital letters, can be reelected because we're a nation of fools, parentheses, some accepted.
Yes, well, that's guilty as charged. And
Barry is a terrific bass player, by the way.
Well, I think,
whatever that's,
you know, I read, you know, I don't know that we're a nation of fools. I think that there are a lot of folks who work very hard and, you know, raising their kids and doing their job and going about the business of their lives and don't spend as much time focused on the details of this than, you know, wonks like I do. And but there was an interesting Greg Sargent from the Washington Post. He writes something called the Plumline Column. And he wrote a column in December, memo to the media, stop giving Trump the headlines he wants. And he put that out again yesterday with regard to this this Susan Rice issue, where he questions about how to be careful about conveying to the American people some of these, you know, just because Trump says it. So, for instance, the New York Times started with the headline, Trump says Susan Rice may have committed a crime. And, well, that's true, but it does not convey until deep in the story that there's no evidence of that. And if you look at what the accusation is, in terms of how the process works, it's not a credible charge. And so I think that, I know this is not the media project, this is the roundtable, but I think part of this is how people get their information and how the media, which, you know, in many cases done a good job, but it has to do a more careful job with how they respond to some of these accusations that Trump and folks make.
Well, you know, we just did talk about this on the Media Project, and it's my opinion that the amount of time that cable news gives to these stories disproportionately impacts the importance of the story. They because of the nature of cable news, it's reported, and it's reported every hour, and it's discussed with various panels, whereas print products and typically are running the same story, but they're running it inside and they're running it in context. Rex Smith made a very interesting observation regarding the impact of Fox News, which was his inclination was to not run very much, if anything, on Susan Rice, but the Times Union was getting a lot of letters from people who were saying, you guys are covering it up. It's all over Fox News, in effect. And that view is out there, and it may well prompt what I would describe as responsible news outlets to put in coverage that they really feel like they shouldn't be covering.
You know, interestingly, I'm in the last night when I was sending out articles, I was looking at this particular story, and I chose the one from the Washington Post to send out simply because the headline was Susan Rice may have committed a crime, Trump says, without providing any evidence.
Yeah, right. The Times early.
That's the headline.
Yeah. Right, so, and the Times did change their headline to Trump suggests Rice committed no crime, citing no evidence.
Right.
But that was only after, you know, the incorrect headline. But here,
no,
Trump's,
not incorrect, evolving.
Well, misleading based on
evolving.
The evidence. But here, Trump succeeded because we're talking about, you know, in the midst of the Syria crisis, in the midst of Trump meeting, you know, with the Chinese, in the midst of him meeting with Crown Prince Abdullah, in the midst of the North Korea, you know, what are people talking about? They're talking about whether or not what Susan Rice did or didn't do. Mm-hmm. And so so that he succeeds. He succeeds in muddling the conversation.
The question is, you're an editor, and the president of the United States makes a pronouncement that Susan Rice may have committed crimes. What do you do with that? Do you ignore it?
You put it in context.
Exactly, and that's what print will do.
But the headline has to match the story.
Well, but the digital edition headline is the headline that is written on the fly, and it's updated constantly throughout the day. In the old days of newspapers, when big city newspapers had three or four editions, the headline on a story and the content of a story in the first edition often was entirely different than in the third and fourth edition. That's just a nature of, well, we got to go to press now. Here's what we know.
Even on the cable wire.
Same thing.
Even on the cable. Exactly. First, the crawl said Nunes steps aside from Russian probe.
Right.
And then, you know, 10 minutes later is Nunes temporarily steps aside from the Russian probe.
Yeah.
So things get changed.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. So it's there. The Times public editor, or in the new column they have on page two, which I really enjoy about the inner workings of the Times, discuss this very point regarding a controversial digital headline they had some weeks ago, and they explained the process. It was we didn't make a mistake. We just were we had to write it. We had to change it as the more information became available to us, as we had more clarity in the story. That's just part of the news business.
Well, I think that Donald Trump, the candidate, showed a very consistent pattern of deflection, of using deflection to change the narrative.
He's very good.
That's
at
one
it.
Thing. He doesn't have depth in policy, but he's a master at manipulation of the national conversation. And I think that we just all have to be very aware that when he does things like this New York Times interview he did yesterday, where throwing out the things he said, that you have to then say, okay, what's next? Because the pattern is when they throw what we used to call gorilla dust, you know, mm-hmm. when he says something to try to deflect, there's usually something that's coming up in the next few days that he did not want the American people to focus on.
Well, for example, I'm standing next to... Gotta go?
Yep, we'll take a break. We'll be right back right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is Thursday, the 6th of April.
Anyway, we think it is.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Thursday. And it's 5 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Thank you very much for being with us. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, and Ira Fussfeld make up the group. Let's go to other issues that are making news. And, of course, I talked about, obviously, talked that we would mention this, and that is the situation in Syria. And the president's view on this, he spoke yesterday and he warned on Wednesday that he would not tolerate the heinous, his word, chemical weapon attack in Syria, opening the door to greater American role in protecting the populations in a vicious civil war that he has always said the United States should avoid. The president declined to offer any details about potential action, but he said the horror of the images of innocent children, innocent babies, choked by poison gas in a rebel-held area of Syria had caused him to reassess his approach only days after the White House declared it would be silly to persist in trying to oust the president, Bashar al-Assad, of Syria. Mr. Trump said, "My attitude toward Syria and Assad has changed very much."
And that's really fascinating, isn't it, that he didn't know what Assad was capable of? That is really interesting that he said, "I've changed my mind. Other human beings changed their mind. I have a right to change my mind." Well, wait a second. You're the president of the United States. You have a huge intelligence bureaucracy. Don't tell me you didn't know what Assad was doing. Wait a second now. It all comes back to the Russians. I've been saying this for so long. Your Mr. Putin, remember him? He loved him in the beginning. Remember that? And you love Putin, and now Putin is the major backer of Assad, and he's not letting it go away, and he's going to back him until the end. So are you going to send airplanes up there to shoot down the Syrian or Russian airplanes? Well, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? What exactly do you have in mind? Some people say, well, we believe that Syria should be cut up into separate states. And how do you do that again? I forget.
Well, this is a guy who continues to blame his predecessor for the way he handled, among other things, Syria, when it was going on, he was tweeting, he being Trump, that he would not go into Syria. So he's basically stepping on his own criticism of Obama because he agreed with Obama. Secondly, I think we were talking before about Nikki Haley and using those pictures. I honestly believe that Trump was impacted by the sight of those pictures, as were many Americans who saw that war in Syria all these years as none of our business and out of sight, out of mind. And so those pictures were dramatic and they were impactful. But three, yes, what is he going to do? He certainly hasn't been specific on a lot of things. He probably correctly is saying, I'm not going to tell you in advance what I'm going to do. It's one of his lines about how, you know, we warn the enemy what we're going to do. But, you know, there are Russian soldiers interspersed with the Syrian Assad soldiers. So is he going to go and start bombing Syrian soldiers and kill a bunch of Russians and start World War III? There are a lot of bad choices here. And I'm happy that he has a solid and well-respected national security team who hopefully will make the right decision and tell Trump this is what we're going to do. Because if Trump is the one who is going to be making that decision, I believe he's incompetent, in case you hadn't heard.
Well, do you have any idea what he should do?
No, I don't. I think it's very complex, and that's why these throwing these bombs from the grandstand, blaming Obama for this and that, when you weren't in his shoes is just ill-suited of a president of the United States.
Yeah, I think that throughout the campaign, Donald Trump was denigrating the Obama administration and Secretary
still.
Clinton on the Syria policy, which I don't think he ever understood. I think what he did yesterday was beyond shameful. I mean, I agree with you, Ira, that it's, you know, no doubt, just like everybody else, when he saw those pictures, he must have taken them deeply to heart, and they are deeply troubling, the pictures of the dead children and the parents holding their dead children. But to suggest, the implication was that Assad had not been killing his own people with chemical weapons before. Well, he's the president of the United States. He gets security briefings. He has to know that Assad has been using chemical weapons against his own people, including women and children, for a long time. There was a major UN report out about this in November or December, which documented in 2012, 13, 14. And then he's reportedly been doing that over the last couple of months. But the hard question now is, what does one do? And while, Ira, you said, in fact, that he has a national security team around him. What I'm troubled by is that he doesn't have a diplomatic team around him, that he does not have a U.S. ambassador to Russia. John Huntsman was nominated but not yet confirmed. He does not have a U.S. ambassador for China. Terry Branstad, former governor of Iowa, nominated. You know, they're still getting the paperwork together. The State Department is, you know, he depleted that when he fired everybody and didn't replace them yet. So he has a lot of military folks around him, but he doesn't have a diplomatic team around him, and he has a Secretary of State who doesn't have experience. Mm-hmm. And these are very, very tricky, difficult times. And you have the combination now of the tough decisions in Syria where there are no good answers, and you have the
North
tough
Korea.
Decisions in North Korea where there are no good answers.
Do you remember a president in our lifetimes who, when having a joint press conference with a leader of another country, uses that opportunity to criticize his predecessor as president?
Well, this is something that is so disturbing about Trump. And I do believe you're right, Ira, that, or the implication of what you're saying is that I don't think that the American people like it.
I don't think so, too.
I don't think they like it. Obama's kept his mouth shut, as former presidents do. He may have said one or two things, but basically he's kept his mouth shut despite severe provocation. And it just adds to Trump's reputation as a bully.
It sends a message around the world of instability in our country, that of a non-peaceful transition of power. It's to use the movie reference, it's like The Godfather when you say you never argue in front of somebody else outside of the family. You want to discuss it among ourselves, it's fine, but you don't criticize the former president when the King of Jordan is standing right next to you.
Well, I think it's a reflection of his lack of understanding of the issues.
I agree.
But the hard question now is what happens. So Secretary of State Tillerson is going to Moscow next week. So, you know, the President Trump today and tomorrow, he's with the Chinese President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so obviously they will discuss issues having to do with North Korea. And no doubt issues of the Middle East will come up because they're all intertwined, as well as a lot of trade and other issues. But what is the solution? You know, I think this is the same challenge that Secretary Clinton and President Obama faced. You could have a no-fly zone. If you have a no-fly zone, then they can't drop chemical weapons on his people. But how do you enforce that? Because as you say, Ira, it's the Russians there. So if somebody violates the no-fly zone, are the U.S. going to shoot a Russian plane out of the air over Syria? No, they are not. You don't want to put our people in that position. Are we going to put boots on the ground in Syria?
Or North Korea, where there are a million people in the army. A million. Can you imagine?
Right.
A million people in that army.
Right. These are all...
And we're sitting there, on the 38th parallel, we've been sitting... How long? Oh, since the Korean War. And despite all the provocations and everything else, what are we going to do?
Right. So what we're going to do is implore the Russians. You know, that's what President Obama tried to do, is get through the UN and others. And so we're going to turn to our NATO allies. Oh, well, we have a president who's been denigrating NATO for over a year. So do we turn to our NATO allies? You know, we will. We're going to need to do that. But how do we do that? We turn to Turkey. Well, you know, that's a little tricky as well. Not to mention that our president has business conflicts of interest with Turkey. It's really a complicated situation, but I think ultimately this has to be a negotiated issue through the UN and NATO and others, where they try to finish what President Obama started, which is to get agreement not to use chemical weapons.
If Trump's hair doesn't change from orange to gray over the next 6 months, we'll know that that's phony hair.
I already know.
So Ira mentioned this early on, but it was the stories to come out of the New York Times interview, one of them being when Donald Trump asked about accusations against Bill O'Reilly, called him a good person. Bill O'Reilly, the embattled Fox News host, received a powerful show of support on Wednesday from a longtime friend, interview subject, and ideological sympathizer and fellow scandal survivor, the President of the United States.
Yeah, well, this is payback. That's what it is. He was there for me. I'm here for him. And tough noogies.
But that's the answer to that question, if you are the president of the United States and he is a friend of yours, is not, I think he's a good person and I think he shouldn't have settled and I don't think he did what's being alleged, is not any of those things. It's, I think he's a good person. I hope what's being charged against him is not true and I wish him well. This is outrageous that the president of the United States would without any evidence, again, is taking this guy's side and saying those allegations are not true. And don't forget, although the crimes are not exactly the same, there are a lot of these people coming out of the woodwork, and we've got another Cosby situation going on here. Yeah. And why Fox News, and I understand the finances of it, but Fox News got rid of Roger Ailes, and why they're hanging on to this guy.
Oh, you know why, Ira. They're hanging on to him because he's extremely popular. He's their leading guy. There are more people watch that show than anything else, and they just don't want to get rid of him.
Well, if they want to be associated with that brand while they're counting all their money, then so be it. But
what do you mean, so be it? Of course, that's what's going on.
It's all about money.
It's not going to. It's you know, the advertisers are starting to come out of, and I believe the number was 30 advertisers have withdrawn.
Yeah, but they're going to other
they're
places.
They're going to other programs.
On Fox.
But at some point in time, if they leave his program entirely, and he has no paid advertising on that show, he's got a really big salary that they've got to prop up. Listen, I don't know how it's going to all turn
out.
Wait a second.
They gave Ailes $40 million as their
that's
settlement.
That's a write-off.
But
again, let's go back to where we started.
And by the way, I think the Cosby thing, to be fair, Cosby is accused of rape. Now, what's happening here is that the man is being accused of being a sexual predator, which he clearly has been accused of, and that is a terrible, terrible thing. I'm not making any excuse for it, but the Cosby thing is rape.
Well, the Cosby analogy is strictly the numbers that are showing up, people who have been quiet all these years and now—
Five settlements in this case.
So, but again, where we started here was with Trump, and I believe that Trump, you want to give him credit for being loyal to his friend, fine, but this is not what a president of the United States should be saying and commenting. And by the way, wasn't it just Trump the other day who hailed April as Sexual Harassment Awareness Month or something to that extent? I mean, this, and this guy saying, of course he believes Bill O'Reilly. Has anybody seen that Access Hollywood tape? I mean, this is his...
Well, it comes off as an endorsement, right?
I mean, absolutely.
And not only to Bill O'Reilly, but to sexual harassment itself. I
agree with you.
I mean, I think that's
it's terrible. There's no two ways around it. It's terrible. Nevertheless, let's remember that after Trump got into all that trouble for grabbing genitals and everything else, still a majority, I believe I'm right about this, a majority of white women in America voted for him. Go explain that, except by saying it goes back to racism in America, down to the South, to Emmett Till. We're going to protect you from the black people, and it is disgusting.
Well, how long can the white women who supported him be figuratively hit over the head with a baseball bat before they say this is not right?
Ira, it's your lips to God's ear, but it's not happening.
Well,
the polling is showing it just isn't happening.
Well, the extent of the O'Reilly story is less than a week old. Let's see how this marinates.
Yeah, don't you think? I mean, this seems like it's holding on day after day after day.
The current version of the story,
yes.
In light of the New York Times story.
Yes.
Yes.
And you just, it doesn't seem like it's going away.
No.
And I don't know that the president's comments help it or hurt it, but it seems... In many cases, that it can't.
Let's watch the numbers on how many people are watching the show, whether the advertisers are going to stay away as opposed to going away in the short run.
I think it helps O'Reilly more than it helps Trump.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Well, I think a couple of things. One is that, you know, there are about 20, 30 advertisers who have left, but there are over 300 people who advertise. And you can Google and get the list. And if you're concerned, you can contact those people.
Well, I don't know about you, but you know, I used to run a newspaper. And if we had a roster of, take a number, 100 advertisers, and all of a sudden a quarter of them decided not to come back because they got mad at us, it would get my attention.
Right. What I'm saying is that, you know, there's still a lot more to go, and there's been public pressure on them, and people can keep up that public pressure if they're concerned about it. You can Google the list. It's everywhere, and you can contact people that if you're concerned about people who advertise on a show, because this fundamentally is all about money. I think this is about Trump's relationship with O'Reilly, but I think it might be more about Trump's relationship with Murdoch.
Because
Kushner's relationship with Murdoch and Trump's daughter's relationship with Murdoch. They have a very tight, close relationship with the Murdochs. But then that raises some serious legal questions because, in fact, Donald Trump is now president of the United States, and he oversees the Justice Department, and Fox News faces an investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office over its handling of these financial settlements on harassment cases. So there is a separate, you know, besides the ethical issues of what Donald Trump said in terms of right or wrong behavior, there's also questionable issues about the president of the United States commenting when there is a potential case before the Justice Department. So, you know, not a piece of this that's getting a lot of focus, but I think it's an important aspect of the story that needs some attention as well.
The man has no self-control. He obviously should not be talking about this and any number of other things that he's talking
about. He's president of the United States. He got here doing what he's doing now. You're not going to convince him that more of the same isn't what is called for in each of these situations.
Well, I don't know what will convince him. I don't know how many more defeats of his proposed legislation. I don't know how many more what is going to happen. But, you know, if he moves forward on his agenda and he believes he's being successful, then it won't change him. But if he doesn't, you know.
And here are 100 days.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of water has gone under the bridge.
And as you say, the president did declare April what is National Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month. But I went back and looked at the proclamation, and there's some language there that he may want to reread. And it notes that, quote, we all share the responsibility to reduce and ultimately end sexual violence. As a nation, we must develop meaningful strategies to eliminate these crimes, including increasing awareness of the problem in our own communities. And he talks about how, you know, it's
does it say anything in there about letting the suits go longer and take them to the wall on it?
Yeah. Right. I mean,
you shouldn't saddle.
Prevention means reducing the prevalence of sexual violence on our streets, in our homes, and in our schools and institutions. Recent research has demonstrated the effectiveness of changing social norms that accept or allow indifference to sexual violence. And that can be done by engaging young people.
Do you think Trump read that?
Peer leadership against condoning violence.
No.
If you think about what he said and you read the text of this, I know I'm being wonky again, but it's just stunning.
That's nonsense.
Did you have
a couple?
Okay, we have a minute.
Okay, here we go. Good morning. I think every time Trump tries to muddy the water, the headlines should, parenthesis, repeatedly be, Trump tries again to divert attention from the current issue.
Well, that may not be in the headline, but it's in the stories.
All right. Good morning, panel. Headlines used for sensational effect are not only misleading as a whole, but they are part of the basic reason people don't think highly of journalism as practiced today. False accusations against Susan Rice or unsubstantiated accusations against Susan Rice are headlines that are not playing into Trump's obfuscation and his lies. Newspapers need a headline editor. They have them, don't they?
Yes, they do. And headlines that are in digital form, particularly on sites that are free, are less impactful in terms of sale, quote unquote. The headlines that might be considered sensational are the ones that are in print where you're trying to scream off the newsstand and make people want to buy the paper. It's not the same paradigm with digital.
We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. My thanks to Alan and Teresa and Ira and for all of you who wrote in as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be back after this short break.